Chapter 16. The organization of the higher education. When we digress to the general question of the political, social, and moral atmosphere in which the English-speaking citizen develops, we left the formal education of the average child, whose development threads through these papers, and holds them together, at about the age of 15, and at the end of the process of schooling. We have now to carry on that development to adult citizenship. It is integral in the New Republican idea that the process of schooling, which is the common atrium to all public service, should be fairly uniform throughout the social body, that although the average upper-class child may have all the advantages his conceivably better mental inheritance, his better home conditions, and his better paid and less overworked teachers may give him, there shall be no disadvantages imposed upon the child of any class, there shall be no burking of the intellectual education for any purpose whatever. To keep poor wretches in serfdom on the land, by depriving them of all but the most rudimentary literary education, as a very considerable element in the new nature study movement certainly intends, is altogether antagonistic to new Republican ideas, and there must be no weeding out of capable and high-minded teachers, by filtering them through grotesque and dishonoring religious tests, dishonoring because compulsory, whatever the real faith of the teacher may be. And at the end of the schooling period there must begin a process of sorting in the mass of the national youth, as far as possible, regardless of their social origins, that will go on throughout life. For the competition of public service must constitute the battle for existence in the civilized state. All round inferiority in school life, failure not simply at this or that, or at the total result which, indeed, may be due very often to the lopsidedness of exceptional gifts, but failure all along the line is a mark of essential inferiority. A certain proportion of boys and girls will have shown this inferiority, will have done little with any of their chances in, or out of school during their school life, and these, when they are poorer class children, will very naturally drop out of the educational process at this stage and pass into employment suited to their capacity, employment which should not carry with it any considerable possibility of prolific marriage. A really well-contrived leaving school examination, and it must be remembered that the theory and science of examination scarcely exists as yet, an examination which would take account of athletic development and moral influence, let us say provisionally by the vote of fellow pupils, and which would be so contrived as to make specially high quality in one department as good as all-round worth, could affect this first classification. It would throw out the worst of the duffers, and fools and louts all along the social scale. What is to become of the rejected of the upper and wealthy class is, I admit, a difficult problem as things are today. At present they carry a loutish ingredient to the public schools, to the army, to Oxford and Cambridge, and it is open to question whether it would not be well to set aside one public school, one especially costly university, and one gentleman's regiment of an attractively smart type, into which this mass of expensive slackness might be drained along a channel of specially high fees, low standards, and agreeable social conditions. That, however, is a quite subsidiary question in this discussion. A day may come, as I have already suggested, when it will be considered as reasonable to insist upon a minimum mental qualification for the administration of property as for any other form of power in the state. Pride and their many advantages, of which one is quite conceivably an average essential superiority, will probably ensure a satisfactory result from the schooling process in the case of a much greater proportion of better class than of lower class boys and girls. Footnote. In most big public schools, I am told, there is a system of superannuation about 16, but I know nothing of the provision for those who are weeded out. right bracket, from the mass who show a satisfactory result at the end of the schooling process, the functional manhood and womanhood of our peoples have to be developed, and we have now to discuss the nature of the second phase of education, the phase that should be the mental parallel and accompaniment of physical adolescence in all the citizens who are to count for strength in the state. There is a break in the whole development of the human being at this age, and it may very well be paralleled by a break in methods and subjects of instruction. In Great Britain, in the case of the wealthier classes, schooling and puerile discipline is prolonged altogether too far, largely through the gross incapacity of our secondary teachers. These men are unable, boring away day after day, week after week, year after year, with vain repetitions, imbecile breaks and new beginnings, through all the vast period from 11 or 12 until 20, to achieve that mastery of Latin and Greek which was once the necessary preliminary to education, and which has become at last, through the secular decline in scholastic energy and capacity due to the withdrawal of interest in these studies, the unattainable educational ideal. These classical pedagogues, however, carry the thing up to 3 or 4 and 20 in the universities, though it is inconceivable that any language spoken since the antediluvian age of leisure can need more than 10 years to learn, and if they could keep the men until 40 or 50 they would still be fumbling away at the keys to the room that was ransacked long ago. But with educated men as teachers and practical handbooks to help, and practical examiners to guide them, there is no reason whatever why the great mass of the linguistic training of the citizen, in the use of his own and any other necessary language, should not be done for good and all by 14, why he should not have a fairly complete mastery of form and quantity through mathematical training and drawing, and why the way should not be clear and immediate for the development of that adult mental edifice, of which this is the foundation. By 14 the power of abstract reasoning, and of an analytical treatment of things is in existence. The learner is now less to be molded, and more to be guided than he was. We want now to give this mind we have established the most stimulating and invigorating training we can. We want to give it a sane, coherent view of our knowledge of the universe in relation to itself, and we want to equip it for its own special work in the world. How, on the basis of the schooling we have predicated, are these ends to be attained? Now let us first have it perfectly clear that this second stage in development lies no more completely within the idea of college than the former lay completely within the idea of school. In the general discussion of these things we are constantly faced by the parallel error too, that we have tried to dissipate in regard to schools, the error that the professor and his lecture, and, in the case of experimental sciences, his laboratory make, or can make, the man, just precisely in the same way that the schoolmaster or schoolmistress is supposed to be omnipotent in the education of the boy or girl. And, unhappily, the professor, unless he is a man of quite exceptional mental power for a professor, shares this groundless opinion. The schoolmaster is undereducated in regard to his work, and incapable of doing it neatly. The professor is too often over-specialized and incapable of forming an intelligent, modest idea of his place in education. And the same consequence flows from the defect of either an attempt to use an improperly large portion of the learner's time and energy, over-direction, and what one may call intellectual sectarianism, are faults from which few college courses are free today. The professor stands between his students and books. He says in lectures in his own way what had far better be left for other men's books to tell. He teaches his beliefs without a court of appeal. Students are kept writing up their notes of his not very brilliant impromptus, and familiarizing themselves with his mental constitution instead of the subject of study. They get no training in the use of books as sources of knowledge and ideas, albeit such a training is one of the most necessary of all acquisitions for an efficient citizen, and whatever discussion the modern student indulges in is all too often treated rather as presumption, to be discouraged than as the most necessary and hopeful of mental processes. Our universities and colleges are still, but imperfectly aware of the recent invention of the printed book, and its intelligent use in this stage of education has made little or no headway against their venerable traditions. That things are only understood by being turned over in the mind, and looked at from various points of view is, of course, altogether too modern a conception for our educationists. At the London Royal College of Science, for example, which is an exceptionally new and efficient college, there is no properly organized escape from the orthodoxy of the lecture theater, no circulating library whatever available to the students, no library, that is, which will ensure a copious supply and exchange of the best books on each subject, and consequently, even to look up an original paper that has been quoted or discussed, involves an expenditure of time that is practically prohibitive of the thing as a general practice. Footnote. There are three very fine libraries in the adjacent South Kensington Museum, especially available to students, but, like almost all existing libraries, they are managed in most respects on lines conceived when a copy of a book was an almost unique thing made specially by the copyist's hand. However much a book is in demand, however cheap its price of publication may be, no library in England, unless it is a modern subscription library, ever gets duplicate copies. This is the cause of the dearness of serious books. They are bought as rarities, and have to be sold in the same spirit. But when libraries learn to buy by the dozen and the hundred, there is no reason why the sort of book now published at 10s/60 should not be sold at a shilling from the beginning. ... The professors, being busy and important men, lecture from their particular standpoints, and having lectured, bolt. There is no provision whatever for the intelligent discussion of knotty points, and the only way to get it is to buttonhole a demonstrator, and induce him to neglect his task of supervising prescribed practical work in favor of educational talk. Let us, therefore, in view of this state of affairs, deal with the general question, how a branch of thought and knowledge may be most beneficially studied under modern conditions, before discussing the more particular question, what subjects should or should not be undertaken. Now the full statement not only of what is known of a subject, but of its difficulties, dark places, and conflicting aspects should be luminously set forth in the college textbooks, large, well-written, well-illustrated books by one or several hands, continually revised and kept abreast of the advance of knowledge by capable and critical-minded young men. Such books are essential and cardinal in proper modern teaching. The country may be speckled with universities until they are as thick as public houses, and each may be provided with its score or so of little lecturers, and if it does not possess one or more good general textbooks in each principal subject, then all this simply means that a great number of inadequate, infertile little textbooks are being dictated, one by each of these lecturers. Not the course of lectures, but the sound. Full textbook should be the basis of college instruction, and this should be supplemented by a greater or lesser number of more or less controversial pamphlets or books, criticizing, expanding or correcting its matter or putting things in a different and profitable way. This textbook should be paralleled in the case of experimental science by a handbook of illustrative and explanatory laboratory work. Portions of the book could be set for preparation at each stage in the course with appropriate experiments. Students could submit difficulties in writing to be dealt with by the professor in conversational lectures, and the reading of the students could be checked by periodic examinations upon cardinal parts, and supplemented, if these examinations showed it to be necessary, by dissertations upon special issues of difficulty. Upon the matters that were distinctively his object, or upon his points of disagreement with the general issues of the book, the professor might lecture in the accepted way. This is surely the proper method of work for adolescent students in any subject, in philology just as much as in comparative anatomy, and in history just as much as in economics. The cheapening of printing, paper, and, above all, of illustration has done away with the last excuse for the vocal course of instruction and the lecturer's diagrams. But it has not done away with them. It is one of the most curious of human phenomena, this persistence of tradition against what one might have imagined the most destructive facts, and in no connection is this aspect more remarkable than in all that concerns the higher stages of education. One might think that somewhere in the 17th century it would have been recognized at the seats of learning that thought and knowledge were progressive things, and that a periodic revision of courses and syllabuses, a periodic recasting of work and scope, a rearrangement of chairs, and of the appliances of the faculties, was as necessary to the continued healthy existence of a university as periodic meals and sleep and exercise are necessary to a man. But even today we are founding universities without any provision for this necessary change, and the chances are that in a century or so they will present just as much backwardness and illiteracy as do the ordinary graduation organizations of Oxford and Cambridge today, that 100 years from now the past graduates of ripe old Birmingham, full of spite against newfangled things, oh fellow can understand, will be crowding up to vote against the substitution of some more modern subject for Uxley they will call the subject, and not comparative anatomy, on the model of Euclid or for the retention of compulsory immersal geography of the 19th century, or on hand bookkeeping in the little go. And should any germinating noble founder read these pages, I would implore him with all the earnestness that is possible in printed matter, to provide that every 50 years, let us say, the whole of his prospective foundation, shall go into solution, shall reapportion its funds, and reorganize the entire mechanism of its work. The idea that a textbook should be regularly reset and reprinted is still quite foreign to the professorial mind, as, indeed, is the idea that the care of textbooks and publications is a university function at all. No one is startled by a proposal to apply L800 or L1000 a year to a new chair in any subject, but to apply that sum merely as a standing charge to the revision and perfection of a specific textbook would seem, even today, quite fantastically extravagant to most university men. Yet what could be more obviously helpful to sound and thorough teaching than for a university, or a group of universities, to sustain a professor in each of the chief subjects of instruction, whose business would be neither teaching as it is now understood, nor research, but the critical and exhaustive editing of the college textbook of his subject, a textbook which would stand in type at the university press, which would be revised annually and reprinted annually, primarily for the use of the matriculated students of the university and incidentally for publication. His business would be not only to bring the work up to date and parallel with all the newest published research, and to invite and consider proposals of contributions and footnotes from men with new views and new matter, but also to substitute for obscure passages fuller and more lucid expositions, to cut down or relegate to smaller type passages of diminishing importance, and to introduce fresh and more efficient illustrations, and his work would be carried on in consultation with the general editor of the university press, who would also be a specialist in modern printing and bookmaking, and who would be constantly taking up, trying, and adopting fresh devices of arrangement, and newer, better, and cheaper methods of printing and illustration. It would not merely raise the general efficiency of the college work of adolescents very greatly, to have a series of textbooks living and growing in each subject at one, or better, at several universities or group universities, but in each subject the periodic change in these books would afford a most valuable corrective to the influence of specialized work, by keeping the specialist worker easily in touch with the current presentation of his science as a whole. The textbook, however good, and the lecturer, however able, are only one of two necessary factors in college work. The reciprocal element is the student's activity. Unless the students are actively engaged not simply in taking in what they are told, but in rearranging it, turning it over, trying and testing it, they are doing little good. We recognize this quite abundantly in the laboratory nowadays, but we neglect it enormously in the more theoretical study of a subject. The facts of a subject, if it is a science, may be got at in the most thorough way, by handling in the laboratory, but the ideas of a subject must be handled in discussion, reproduction and dispute. Examinations by teachers who understand this very fine art, in which the student is obliged to restate, apply, and use the principles of his subject, are of the utmost value in keeping the mind active, and not simply receptive. They are just as good, and as vitally necessary as examination papers which merely demand definitions, and lists and bald facts are bad. And then there might be discussions if the professor were clever enough to conduct them. If the students of a class could be induced to submit propositions for discussion, from which a topic could be selected, and could then be made to prepare for a disputation to which all would have to contribute, with the professor as a controlling influence in the chair, to check facts and logic and to conclude, it would have the value of a dozen lectures. But professors who are under the burthen of perhaps 90 or 100 lectures a year cannot be expected to do anything of this sort. Directed reading, conferences on knotty points, special lectures followed by the questioning of the lecturer, discussions upon matters of opinion, laboratory work when needful, fairly frequent test examinations, and a final examination for places, are the proper ingredients of a good modern college course, and in the necessity of leaving the professor's energies free for the direction of all this really educational work, lies another reason for that complete, explicit, well-arranged textbook upon which I am insisting. Coming back now from these general propositions about books and teaching to our mass of young people about 15 years old, our adolescent nation, who have accomplished their schooling, and are ready for the college phase, we have to consider what subjects they are to be taught, and how far they are to go with these subjects. Whether they are to give all, or part of their time to these college studies, whether they are going to pursue them in evening classes, or before breakfast in the morning, or during the livelong day is a question of secondary conveniences, that may very well be disregarded here. We are concerned with the general architecture now, and not with the tactical necessities of the clerk of the works. Footnote. But I may perhaps point out here how integral to a sane man-making scheme is the raising of the minimum age at which children may work. A day will come, I hope, when even the partial employment of children under 15 will be prohibited, and when, as Mr. Sidney Webb suggested some time ago, employment up to the age of 21 will be limited to so few hours a week, his suggestion was 30, as to leave a broad margin for the more or less compulsory college work and physical training that are becoming essential to the modern citizen. We need waste little time nowadays, I submit, in disposing of encyclopedic conceptions of college education, conceptions that played a part in almost all educational schemes. Bentham's stupendous Chrestomathia is the fearful example before the middle 19th century. We are all agreed in theory, at any rate, that to know one subject or group of subjects exhaustively is far better than a universal smattering, that the ideal of education is more particularly all about something with something about everything in a very subordinate place. The fact remains that the normal curriculum of our higher schools and colleges is a pointless non-educational miscellany, and the average graduate in arts knows something, but not enough, of science, mathematics, Latin, Greek, literature, and history. He has paid tribute to several conflicting schemes of education, and is a credit to none. We have to get rid of this state of affairs, and we have to provide a substantial mental training which will lead at last to a broad and comprehensive view of things, and which will be a training in generalization, abstraction, and the examination of evidence, stimulating and disciplining the imagination and developing the habit of patient, sustained, enterprising and thorough work, and we have to add a general culture, a circle of ideas about moral, aesthetic, and social matters, that shall form a common basis for the social and intellectual life of the community. The former of these two elements must at some stage develop after 2 or 5 or 7, or some such period of years, which may be different in different cases, into the special training for the definite function of the individual in the social body, whether as engineer, business manager, doctor, priest, journalist, public administrator, professional soldier, or what not. And before we ask what must constitute it may be well to define the relation between the first and the second section of the college stage of education. It is that will constitute the essential work of the college, which will be the especial concern of the professorial staff, which will count in examinations, and I conceive it as occupying typically 4 full working days in the week, 4 good, hard driving days, and no more, of the student's time. The remaining 3, so far as they are not engaged by physical exercise, military training, and mere amusement, must be given to which I imagine an altogether more general, discursive, various, and spontaneous series of activities. To put the thing briefly, with the use of a convenient slang word, is grind, and is general culture, elements that are altogether too greatly confused in adolescent education. A large number of people will consider it right and proper that on the 7th day of the week, should become devotional exercise or religious thought and discussion. I would submit that under there should be formally recognized certain extremely valuable educational influences that are at present too often regarded as irregular or improper invasions of school and college work, the collegiate debating society, for example, private reading, experimental science outside the curriculum, and essays in various arts. It should be possible to provide a certain definite number of hours weekly in which the student should be required merely to show that he was doing something of a developmental kind. He would have his choice between the library. Every college ought to have a good, and not too priggishly conceived library, in which he might either read or write, or the music master, the debating society, the museum, the art studio, the dramatic society, or any concern of the sort that the college authorities had satisfactory reason for supposing to be alive and efficient. In addition, II should include certain minor, but necessary studies not included in but pursued for all that with a certain insistence, taught or directed, and controlled perhaps by examinations. If, for example, the acquisition of a foreign language was a part of the preliminary schooling, it could be kept alive by a more fastidious study in the higher grade. For the making of the good, all-round, average citizen, will be the essential educational factor, but for the boy or girl with a dash of genius, will rise from the level of culture to that of a great opportunity. What subject or group of subjects is to constitute I? There are at least three, and quite probably beyond the very limited range of my knowledge there are other arrangements of studies that can be contrived to supply this essential substantial part of the college course. Each suffices completely, and I would hesitate to express any preference for one or the other. Each has its special direction toward certain sorts of adult function, and for that reason it may be suggested that the secondary education of an English-speaking country might very well afford all three or more types of secondary course. The small schools might specialize upon the type locally most desirable, the larger might group its triplicate or quadruplicate system of sustained and serious courses about a common library and the common arrangements for Section I of the college scheme. The first of these possible college courses, and the one most likely to be useful and fruitful for the mass of the male population in a modern community, is an expansion of the physics of the schooling stage. It may be very conveniently spoken of as the natural philosophy course. Its backbone will be an interlocking arrangement of mathematics, physics, and the principles of chemistry, and it will take up as illustrative and mind-expanding exercises, astronomy, geography, and geology conceived as a general history of the Earth. Holding the whole together will be the theory of the conservation of energy in its countless aspects, and a speculative discussion of the constitution of matter. A certain minimum of historical and political reading, and of general ibrary would be insisted upon in Section I. This could be made a quite noble and spacious course of instruction extending over from 3 to 5 years, from 14 or 15 up to 18 or 21, or even longer in the case of those partially employed. Its less successful products would drop out, it might be, before completion, to take up the work of more or less skilled artisans and technical workers, and its more successful ones would pass some of them into the technical colleges for special industries with a view to business direction, into special study for the engineering trades, for the profession of soldiering. Footnote. I may perhaps explain that my conception of military organization is a universal service of citizens, non-professional soldiers who will be trained, possibly in boyhood and youth, to shoot very well indeed, to ride either horses or bicycles, and to take up positions and move quickly and easily in organized bodies, and, in addition, a special graduated profession of soldiers who will be in their various ranks engineers, gunners, special force men of various sorts, and, in the higher ranks, masters of all the organization and methods necessary for the rapid and effective utilization of the non professional manhood of the country, of volunteers, militia, or short service enlistment levies, drawn from this general supply, and of all the machinery of communication, provisioning, and so forth. They will not be necessarily the social superiors of their commands, but they will naturally exercise the same authoritative command in warfare that a doctor does in a sick room. ... or for the naval and mercantile services, or into research and the literature of science. Some also would pass on to study for the profession of medicine through more special work in chemistry and physiology, and some with a proclivity for drawing and design would become architects, designers of appliances, and the like. The idea of the ordinary development of this course is not so very remote from what already exists in Great Britain as the organized science school, but, as with all these courses, it would be done in varying degrees of thoroughness and extension under varying conditions. This is the first of my three alternative college courses. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.